This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening, I'm Claudine Cheong. On today's edition of The Informer, we talk to Olivia Ball, the Greens candidate for Lord Mayor of Melbourne, and we discuss the results of the Burnet Institute's latest sex, drugs and rock and roll survey of young people.
Last week, the Greens announced their candidate for Lord Mayor of Melbourne, Olivia Ball. She's a former psychologist and a human rights activist and was previously a candidate in the federal election for the seat of Maribyrnong, Bill Shorten's seat. Thanks for joining us, Olivia.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you in the studio. The Greens have never had a Lord Mayor in any of the Australian Australian capital cities. What do you think your chances are in this election?
It's by no means guaranteed. We are the underdog, but it is certainly possible. We came quite close last time, very close indeed, and we're certainly in this to win.
For those people that aren't really aware, now it's sort of a divided election because in the city of Melbourne you vote for either the Lord Mayor or you vote for a councillor. So you can't stand as both. It's not like everybody that gets elected goes up to say, well, you know, will I be the Lord Mayor or whatever. It's quite different. So you're standing just as a Lord Mayor candidate.
That's correct. The city of Melbourne and Geelong are different from all other councils in that regard. The Lord Mayor and Deputy Lord Mayor are elected directly by the people, and in the case of the City of Melbourne, by business interests. The two are on the same ticket. So you either get the two on the one ticket, the Mayor and Deputy Lord Mayor, or neither, whoever wins.
Yeah, so it's business interests, residents, of course, and of course the City of Melbourne has seen a huge explosion in people that actually live in the CBD and in the surrounding suburbs, which become part of that electorate, and also people that own property as well. Now, I mean, there'd be a lot of people that own property throughout the CBD that aren't necessarily residents. What are the main concerns, do you think, that all electors that are eligible for this election have for the City of Melbourne?
Are concerned. Everybody can see when there's inappropriate development, and of course the driver for good design, good development and what makes a livable city occurs at council level. And the Greens have a vision for a livable city, a city for everyone, that it welcomes everyone, that is accessible and welcoming to people of every age, disability, ability, background, sexuality, that it is for everyone and is ultimately a place of equality and dignity, and for my priority is human rights and, of course, the environment. These are the things that the Greens stand for that we want to implement in local government.
A livable city sounds very idealistic and, you know, at the moment, you know, I've got, a couple of billion dollars in the bank and I'm thinking of putting up a 60-storey glass-encased tower that just looks really good on paper, and I can go to the City of Melbourne and find out that they reject that, and then I can go to the state government and the planning minister and, you know, I can end up with that approved through a long process. You know, what difference is it going to make being the Lord Mayor of Melbourne?
If the Greens win the Lord Mayoral ticket, that would be two additional places for the Greens on council. And we are a voice for progressive Melbourne. We are a voice that will not act in the interests exclusively of developers, but for all people equally. We are concerned that citizens don't have an equal voice, an equal vote on council. Your listeners may not be aware of this, but businesses get two votes for every resident.
Yeah.
And of course, as you pointed out, non-residents get a vote too, and many of them live abroad or far away and have no idea of really what is important in Melbourne. The Greens are very proud that all of our candidates are local residents of the municipality, which is not true of other members on council, and that we have a vested interest and a very passionate interest in the livability, the decency, the cleanliness in every sense, clean politics, clean energy, clean environment of our municipality. And that is the progressive voice that people can vote for in the Melbourne City Council.
Look, I also own a rental property in part of the city of Melbourne, and the rates haven't been going up, so I'm pretty pleased about that. The area that this property is really nice, and you know, I'm just sort of thinking, why on earth should I change from, I don't know whether, is Robert Doyle standing again for Lord Mayor? I can't see him
He intends to, yes.
So, you know, why on earth should I be voting for Olivia as Lord Mayor? Because, you know, I'm pretty happy with the job that's being done at the moment.
I'm very proud of the Greens' track record on Melbourne City Council. We have two Greens councillors at the moment, one who's been there one term and one who's been there for two terms, and they have improved the transparency and accountability of council, which is something is a part of the Greens platform. For instance, having council meetings recorded and available on the public record, things like that. And so, and having key council documents available in community languages. This is a way of making council more accessible to everyone and more ultimately democratic. And this is something that we want to pursue further. It's very important that council decisions are not captured by vested interests. We will not accept, the Greens do not accept political donations from key interest groups that have undue influence or potentially a very negative influence on
such
political decision makers.
And
at local government level, the key thing is property developers, yes.
Yeah.
At other levels, it might be fossil fuel donations or tobacco or alcohol and so forth. But the key thing, and this is a very real problem on Melbourne City Council, is developer donations. Not only does that skew decision making, but it does mean where councillors admit their conflict of interest through having received such donations, they have to sit aside and not vote on a particular motion. Now, if there's so many councillors who are receiving developer donations, and there are, that enough of them sit aside on any particular decision that's made, and there is no quorum or required minimum number of people present able to vote, the vote cannot go ahead. Mm. So it's quite possible that nothing happens and things are stymied. And this is no way to run local government. So the Greens are very proud of our policies, and we enact those, and we live by those, put them into practice already at every level of government, and that is not to accept developer donations, and all donations we do accept are declared up front and transparently. Anything above $1,000 in any financial year is immediately put on our website. Whereas other parties announce that after the election.
Sure.
Which, of course, is too late to find out who owns your candidates, you know.
That's
so
right.
Transparent.
It gives a lot of accountability then to the council and for making the decisions that they ultimately make. Just going back to a point that you mentioned before, Olivia, and that was about livability.
Yes.
I think you've previously mentioned the issue in the city of homelessness.
Yes.
And it's clearly a big issue.
Yes.
Do you have any policies or ideas about how you would best tackle that?
Yes, we are very concerned, and I'm sure people who are living and working in the CBD will have noticed a dramatic increase of people living rough on our streets, and that is only the tip of the iceberg of homelessness, and that ultimately is driven by housing unaffordability. So they are serious concerns of the Greens, and we haven't yet announced our policy on homelessness, but we will be doing that. But that is a first principles premise that I will bring as Lord Mayor. Because I'm a professional human rights advocate, that's what I do for a living, it's what my life's project and what I've always done. I did start as a psychologist, as you mentioned, but I was working primarily with refugee survivors of torture and trauma.
Yeah.
So clearly there's a close segue then I made into advocacy for human rights of all kinds. So I start from the premise that human rights are real and binding, and we have to work to implement them. So your listeners wouldn't have to come to me and persuade me of their rights.
True.
Because I accept those from the very beginning. And homelessness in particular it's a national crisis. It's not just here in the city of Melbourne. It is a national crisis, and it's a kind of issue that falls between levels of government because we don't have clear accountability on this issue. But the fact remains that we all have a right to housing, and we have a right to appropriate and affordable and accessible housing for everyone. And I would be working with all levels of government, state and federal, to the extent possible, to realise that right for everyone in Melbourne.
Also, the CBD and the City of Melbourne is about to go through some huge changes. The Metro program is about to be commenced very soon, and the CBD itself is going to, well, first off, become a work zone for a number of years, but it's going to be transformed into something quite amazing as well. So do you have a plan or a thought about, you know, the future of the CBD of Melbourne?
The Greens, of course, as you would expect, are very strong on public transport and
active
transport.
Well, they would have welcomed the Metro project, which
so
I think
Metro,
many Victorians have.
Yes, gives us a second loop through the city. There are other projects that have not given the go-ahead yet, so we still want Doncaster Rail and other means of people getting in and out of the city efficiently, cleanly, and with reduced or zero emissions. This is terribly important for the thousands of people who come into town every day. So we, of course, are very strong advocates of public transport initiatives and active transport, and having those active meaning walking and cycling, having those different forms of transport well designed to integrate successfully. So even, say, a bike share scheme, making sure those bike share stations are where you might get off a tram or come out of a train station and so forth.
Look, even under the current council, I've noticed that more and more apartment blocks no longer have the requirement. I served on an owners corporation for a while, and I learnt that a lot of new apartment blocks don't actually have to have one car space per apartment. And the idea is that hopefully people will live in the city and actually not have a car, because there is great public transport, and there'll be even more in the future as well. But from my own personal experience, while I lived in the CBD itself, it was becoming more and more difficult to get in and out of the city. So maybe I'm not the sort of resident that the CBD is trying to attract. But, I enjoyed living in the city an awful lot, but it is becoming quite congested. It's becoming quite difficult to negotiate. What do you think the plans are of the future along, making it easy for people to get in and out of the city and actually live in the CBD itself?
Yes. Well, again, the promotion of public transport is key. And the City of Melbourne is unusual in that we have a very high, higher than other councils, rate of active transport and public transport. Of course, most people who come to town to work who are from outside of the City of Melbourne do so on public transport, because driving would just, for most people, be out of the question. Mm-hmm. I myself don't have off-street car parking, and we rely on... occasionally borrow a car, but also use car share schemes for our needs when they are not met by public transport. So by and large, because we are generally well serviced in the inner city by public transport, we can use public transport for all purposes. And for years, for most of my life, I've not owned a car.
Look, it's been great having you on here tonight on The Informer, Olivia. The council elections aren't until October, so it's great to be able to find out at least one of the candidates' views, and hopefully we'll be able to get on to more people that are standing in these council elections coming up. So thanks once again, Olivia Ball, and there'll be more in a moment on The Informer. Okay, there's been another set of survey results come out from the Burnet Institute. In 2016, the Burnet Institute has conducted once again the Sex, Drugs and Rock and Roll Survey with young people, this time online. This survey looks at sexual behaviours, alcohol and drug use, mental health and pornography use in the 15 to 29-year-old age group. The preliminary results are in, and tonight on The Informer we're joined by Megan Lim, Senior Research Fellow, Head of Sexual and Young People's Health Research Program at the Burnet Institute in Melbourne. Hello, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
One of the longest titles I've come across, but a great job and an important job. The Burnet Institute is certainly no stranger to the airways of Joy 94.9. Now, this survey differs a little bit to the previous studies, which have been going since 2005, because it's online now. And how were they conducted previously to 2015?
Well, we actually used to go to the Big Day Out Music Festival. That's why it's called the Sex, Drugs and Rock and Roll Survey. And we do our survey actually on the grounds on the day at the Big Day Out. But unfortunately, the Big Day Out no longer exists, so we had to find an alternative way of administering our survey.
I'm not going to ask you whether you got free tickets to the Big Day Out, but do you think that the results are different in previous years now that you're doing it online? Is it more honest? Is it more representative? What have you noticed? How different are the results from those previous years on the ground compared to online now?
Yeah, there's definitely some differences. I think probably the biggest thing is the people who we surveyed at the Big Day Out tended to use a lot more drugs and drink a lot more alcohol, whereas the group we're surveying online are more in line with the general population in those terms. However, the sexual behaviours are fairly consistent across between the Big Day Out and the online survey.
So with the with the Big Day Out, that wasn't a particular kind of population. How did you get participants for this survey?
So we advertised on social media, particularly on Facebook, and we did try as much as possible to target people who we think would have been possible Big Day Out attendees, so people who liked the Big Day Out on Facebook or other similar music festivals. So we tried to promote it that way to get as close as we could, but still fairly different.
Just going to some of the, you've published some a summary of results, and just looking at some of these, looking at the knowledge of STIs, there's a score out of 9, and you've got, you said the, on average, participants scored 6 out of 9. Is that, would you call that good or poor, and how's that compared to previous surveys?
It's consistent with previous surveys. One thing that's quite interesting we've found is that over the last 12 years that we've been doing the surveys, there's really been very little change at all in people's knowledge of STIs and their diagnosis and treatment. So, you know, people really haven't been learning more in the last 12 years despite several campaigns trying to educate people, which is quite interesting. But so even though 6 out of 9, it's not a terrible score, but some of the questions are pretty easy, I think. So,
Megan, there's
a section. Hope that people get them right.
Sorry for cutting across you there. There's a section there on sexting, which, as we might be aware, is now an offence in Victoria. But that, can you walk us through those results about sexting?
Yep. So just to clarify, sexting is legal now, but just unwanted sexting or forwarding on of a sex without permission.
Yes.
The offence, yes. So what we found is that sexting was really common. About 60% of people had engaged in sexting ever in their lives. But one thing we looked at particularly was whether people had forwarded a sex they'd received to a third party, and 7% of people said that they'd done that, which is quite concerning. It's a small number, but it's concerning because it can be quite an upsetting thing to happen to you.
It is. And I suppose related directly to what you've just mentioned, the issue of bullying, you raise that in the report. There's, and you cover a lot of different types of bullying, being cyberbullying, homophobic and transphobic bullying, racial bullying, bullying at school. What did you find as a result of the survey in relation to bullying?
So 20% of people said that they'd been bullied just in the past 6 months, so that, 1 in 5 people. And I guess remembering that these aren't just, you know, teenagers as well. There's plenty of young adults as well. So, yeah, and interestingly, workplace bullying was the most commonly reported
Type
of bullying.
Has that number gone up in comparison to other previous surveys?
This is actually the first time we've asked about bullying.
Okay.
So it's, yeah, a new topic for us.
Does it strike you as a relatively high number, though, 1 in 5?
I think so,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't asked about the severity of the bullying or whether it's just been a one-off or ongoing.
And, in fact, one of the largest segments of that was actually workplace bullying, which I can imagine may be quite prevalent with young people. Another part of your section looked at pornography, which was about whether people had intentionally watched pornography. Now, strangely enough, well, maybe not so strangely, male participants were more likely than female participants to report watching porn on a daily or almost daily basis, 35% compared to 3%. Is that trending in the same way that previous studies have also shown?
Yeah, it does seem like the prevalence of pornography viewing is increasing over time from the limited data that we've been able to collect about it. But certainly that's much higher than we found in our survey last year.
I like the way that, you know, you've actually looked at some of the answers and opinions about how there can be positive, neutral and negative influences of that pornography on different people. I mean, that's quite amazing as well.
Yeah. And also even sometimes the same people would say, you know, pornography's had some positive impacts on my life, but then they've also noted that there's some negative impacts as well. So even individuals find sort of mixed effects pornography on their lives.
Megan, it's great having you on The Informer tonight. We look forward to hearing about them, the study being published. It's going to be published in one of the major publications for medicine, and it's great having you be part of The Informer tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you too.
To get an update on everything that's happening over in the UK and Europe, we chat to web editor of Attitude magazine, Will Stroud. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, James. I'm speaking to you as always.
And you. Now, you've got an update on one of the kind of biggest cases that we've seen coming out of the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. So this has been the news just today, actually. The ongoing investigation into Stephen Port, the man from London who's alleged to have killed four men he met on Grindr over an 18-month period between 2013 and 2015. So he's actually appeared at the Old Bailey in London today, and he's already been charged with the murders of four men. He was arrested at the sort of end of last year, and they've actually added more charges, which include poisoning, rape and sexual assault of up to eight other men.
Oh my God.
So obviously a huge ongoing case. This trial has sort of, it's been pushed back a couple of times now because of the sort of breadth of this investigation, as more sort of men or people that have come into contact with Stephen Port have come forward. This actually all kicked off last year when he was arrested. Basically, they'd been finding, you know, several months apart, the bodies of several gay men turning up in and around this churchyard in East London, seemingly that had overdosed from the party drug that's, you know, often common on the gay scene, GHB.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that they'd actually met this man, Stephen Port, on gay dating apps. He'd taken them to his house where he had then poisoned them and intentionally given them overdoses of this drug before leaving their bodies in and around this nearby churchyard.
Oh, my goodness. Whereabouts in the UK was this?
This is in East London.
Oh, right.
So they were all the victims, all from London, had gone to Stephen Port's house. And obviously, as this investigation has carried on, he's been charged with the killings. Obviously, he pleaded not guilty to them. And as the police investigated, they've asked anyone else that may have come into contact with him on these gay dating apps to come forward. And, you know, it turns out that people have, and now he's facing these extra charges of, again, poisoning people with intent to harm, rape, sexual assault. So obviously a hugely prolific, sort of criminal potentially that's facing these charges. And obviously a reminder that, you know, of the sort of potential dangers of meeting people you don't know on gay dating apps, as well as, you know, taking drugs or having them administered by someone you don't necessarily know.
Yeah. So these attacks were kind of going over quite a long period of time. Is there any idea why it was taking so long to find this man?
Well, basically, this is the Metropolitan Police. They've referred themselves to the Independent Police Complaints Commission over the handling of this case, and they have come under a lot of criticism. Obviously, these bodies were all found in and around a very sort of small, specific area of London, in East London, in Barking. And actually, you know, it was four bodies over a year to 18 months. But the police didn't link these crimes. And because, I guess, of the nature, the sort of showing they died from overdoses, hadn't actually linked them, and they weren't investigating them as murders at all. So it was actually only after the fourth body turned up that they actually started to look into this and then linked them back to this man, Stephen Port. But they have come in for a lot of criticism for it, and especially, I guess, when you think about, you know, sort of often, you know, the rise of things like sort of chemsex here in London. So obviously, potentially sort of prejudicial views against gay men who have been found dead like this, and not necessarily working out that foul play was at hand.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happens next? He's going to trial and, he's currently in trial?
Yeah, well, the investigation is ongoing. These new charges have been brought today against other, you know, victims who have survived their encounters. Mm-hmm. He's pleaded not guilty to all charges. And so obviously this investigation is still ongoing, and I think he's scheduled to appear, you know, back in court for the trial proper in October this year.
Right. Okay, well, I guess we'll chat then to find out what happens with this man. Will Stroud, web editor of Attitude magazine, thank you so much for joining us again this morning.
No, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9. Thanks to tonight's guests, Olivia Ball, candidate for Lord Mayor, and Megan Lim from the Burnett Institute. For a podcast of today's program and other stories, visit joy.org.au/theinformer. This has been Paul McClure, David Gale, and Claudine Cheung.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.